All right, so before we jump into this week's topic, I want to ask if there are any questions related to sort of where we've been in the overall sweep of the conversation or class. Anything stick out bothering you so far? Okay. What's that?
The fact
that we started with war, like as a people or as a class or what?
As a topic.
Oh, as a topic. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a difficult one. It's also a perennial topic that in a lot of ways I think is very helpful when it, in the way that it, just war thinking can clarify our moral thinking as a whole, because there's been so much reflection done on it that it's helpful as a way of working by analogy from some of those. So I don't know if you mentioned it, but when I was talking with Father Casey about just war last week, you know, just telling him this is sort of how I would approach it or whatever, I told him that I tend to view the work of Martin Luther King Jr. through a lens of just war, which is a little counterintuitive because he's well known for his, you know, sort of nonviolent approach or whatever. But if you think about how he worked through the civil rights movement and took on political campaigns, the sort of civil rights campaigns, they follow pretty closely a really nicely delineated just war logic, which is to say that you could identify a cause, a just cause for political action. You could identify an enemy in a particular way, right? Like the political power, you know, brokers in Birmingham, for instance, or something. And you identify like a mission, an objective. And this is, I think, really important because one of the things that you notice if you read about King, for instance, in the civil rights movement, is the strictly delimited sort of nature of the objectives that they were pursuing, right? So you mobilize an entire, the entire black population of one community that's already bearing the burdens of political injustice at an extraordinary level, and you mobilize them for an entire year to not use the bus system, right? Which causes all sorts of problems for everyone. He at the outset identifies what they're after, which is not total civil rights, not the end of racism, not like it's a better seat on a bus, right? And this is a nice just war principle, once that objective has been realized, once the enemy surrenders, you actually stop the prosecution. Right? It would be very easy to justify and say, well, now we got this, let's go on and get some more, right? Let's, but no, you like move on and you go, it's very tactical and you go to the next operation. So I think that on the whole, just war reasoning is really helpful as a way of thinking through the justice of a lot of our actions, because it so magnifies the weight or the gravity of the situation in which we're actually having to make decisions and take on the responsibility of moral action.
It's a slippery slope.
What's that?
The justification. I mean, you could back up the past, could use it for some of the violent actions.
Sure.
It's a slippery slope.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope. One thing that's important to keep in mind is that just war doctrines emerge as a way of limiting warfare. So it's meant to help you come to see if an action is justified, if you're justified in undertaking it. Not so it might be better to call it justified war rather than to call it just war, like that there is like that it achieves some sort of justice simpliciter. Just war is meant to say we rule out certain sorts of violence. So if you're not a real authority, like if you don't have real genuine political authority, if you don't have a really just cause, if you haven't exhausted all of the other options. In other words, if you were a tyrant and you wanted to go to war, you wouldn't care about any of those things. So just war is a way of limiting the kinds of aggressions that we undertake rather than trying to give us the tools we need to justify whatever it is that we want to do. But that presupposes a certain set of virtues on the part of the people who are exercising it, right? Which it has to. All morality does. This is why you can't just talk about what I called in the first session states of affairs. You have to talk about the agents who are engaged in the reasoning as well. Alright, a couple of announcements. First is that we, after today, have 2 weeks off in succession. So there's some sort of set of events on Sunday mornings, both next week and the week after, which I strongly encourage you to attend. I don't know what they are.
Just really briefly,
yeah.
Next week is In Gathering Sunday, so we meet one service combined at 10 a.m. followed by Fig Fest. The following week, please do plan to come to formation. We're going to have a parish-wide forum at which Father Casey will speak. In here.
Okay. There you go.
Okay.
Now I do strongly encourage you to attend. I know what you're attending. The second thing is next weekend at the Episcopal Church of the Incarnation on Sunday evening, I think it's at 6 or 7, I can't remember. We can send out an email about it. Jerry McKinney, Dr. Gerald McKinney from the University of Notre Dame, is going to be... So he's coming into town to do an event with... me and a few of my colleagues on Christian ethics, and he is going to be giving a lecture on at Church of the Incarnation on structural racism, or on racism, sort of the legacy and what. So he's giving a lecture next Sunday night at Church of the Incarnation. If you're interested in attending, that would be a really nice complement to this class. Okay. So this week's topic is economics, and it, like all the other topics that we will engage, is complicated, but it enjoys its own sorts of complications, namely that you can easily divide the topic into at least three categories, which we will probably do here in just a few minutes to sort of think about a case or an actual topic on the ground, which is to say personal finance, like what you do with your own money. Public policy, the kinds of decisions we make about, say, taxation or what have you. And related to that, the sort of giant, the nature of corporations and business, right? So finance, what one theologian calls finance-dominated capitalism. So it's not just about making money in exchange of goods, but like the financial instruments that make possible incredible returns, an investment with no goods at all changing hands. So that is sort of the macro level of public policy and actual like economic theory or action. And then thirdly, so personal finance, public policy, or the large stuff. And then thirdly, what we could call like churchly economics, what the church has to do with money. I did not know that this was going to be stewardship season. I guess if I would have given any reflection, I would have recognized that. But I just, actually what I did was cut and paste from a syllabus from a moral theology course that I teach and said, these are the topics I'll talk about, and then added a couple. And I didn't realize this one would dovetail. But the logic is something like this. Politics is a very wide, set of relationships in which we are always already intricately intertwined, right? We exist as political animals, or at least as social creatures. And so we started by talking about politics as the widest sort of arc of our social relationships where moral problems can arise and the kinds of decisions we need to make. War is a particular instantiation of political action. It is, and especially justified war, you can't have, this is one of the problems with asymmetrical or contemporary warfare, when you don't have state agents. It's hard to follow the traditional criteria of just war reasoning because you don't have regular political agents, but in a traditional form of warfare, war is between genuine political authorities, right? And so we're just narrowing down. So now we've gotten from the political to particular political actions of the gravest sort, which is war, and now to particular, say, domestic relationships within political life, right? And the word domestic there is actually probably a pretty good segue, because when we talk about economics, it's helpful to know that the word itself, economics, means household, roughly. I mean, it comes from the word oikos, which means household. So it's the management of a house. So it has to do with everything, the management of, and this is why that sort of three-phased analysis can work. from personal finance to sort of public policy all into the church, right? Because these are all different versions of the same sort of overlapping households. We exist within them. So if you think of a traditional, like, ancient household where you have, like, different, like, quite literally different types of people in the household, right? You've got a lord of the manor, you've got a lot of times it would be the wife who's running the household, you've got servants, you've got children, you've got all this sort of stuff, and they're in different parts of the household, and so the coordination that's required to actually make a household run is very similar, although scaled way down, to the sorts of coordination that's required to make a common people. A people, a nation, or something, make it run. And so you're talking about management of different groups. Any questions about that so far? Tracking? Okay. So the way that I want to proceed, as I said a couple of weeks ago, each week is to start by introducing a topic and then give you one or two sort of principles of moral reason, things that we can use to do our reflection on what's going on, and then to turn to the cases themselves. So I want to do this in three quick moves. The first is to mention a few principles. The second is to mention some considerations about the topic of economics. And then fourth, to just mention the place of the poor and to have a quick gesture at the place of the poor in Christian thought. So principles we've already mentioned, and I'm going to run through these very briefly, are solidarity, which is really important in this one, which is to be in genuine relationship with the poor, to put it in kind of a very flat way. Subsidiarity is the idea that any moral problem or any problem that we find should be addressed at the lowest level of institution, the lowest institutional level possible for that to be addressed. So it's not the state's decision how to raise your children. That's actually your family institutional responsibility, not the state's. But the flip side of this is that there are genuine concerns that have to be addressed at the highest possible level, like warfare. It's not your prerogative to go to war with, I don't know, Mexico, right? You can't just do that. So subsidiarity is that there are certain things that have to be addressed at a certain level. The principle of double effect, which we discussed last week, so the intention of the action is as important in the moral, in the analysis of it, as the act itself, and in fact helps identify what kind of action it is, namely whether it is surgery or murder, would be one way of very quickly pointing out the difference, right? So two other principles, and I'm using that word loosely here in the first one, that one we've already discussed, that I want to talk about this week, is the idea of ethics itself as being something about ordering our desires. Now, I mentioned this before, that we are, some scholars put it, bundles of love. We're just like, we just love things. We're just attracted to things. We just desire things, right? And so that part of the task of Christian ethics is to help us reflect on how to rightly order those desires so that we don't love things inordinately, which is the wrong things too much, or disorderedly, right? So that we don't love the right things in the right way. And so desire, just the simple idea of desire or attraction or affection, being drawn to something, is a natural part of what it means to be human. Just want things. But to have our desires shaped is always a moral concern. Just keep that in mind. This is going to be very, very important in just a couple of minutes. All right, the last principle that I want to talk about is what's called incommensurability. Have you ever heard this word? Incommensurability? It just means that there's no common standard of measurement between two goods. So what you think of, so the good of, say, a computer is, let's say, $1,100. It's worth a certain set of something, right? But the good of spending time with, I don't know, your children can't be measured on that same scale. There is no common standard of measurement. These goods are incommensurable, a computer and time with your children. The way that we try to impose a common standard of measurement is money. Right? So you give me so much time away from your children, and I'll give you $1,100. And you can turn that $1,100 into a computer, which is actually the number of like units of good that other people on the other side of the world had to spend away from their children, in mines, in factories, etc., etc., etc. And the one thing that holds all of these to a common standard of value, these disparate goods, is money. That's how we exchange goods. But not just goods like, you know, meat and candles, like the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker, but goods as in what is good, what it is that we deeply value and should. Incommensurability says, look, there are certain things that simply do not submit to that level of equalization. Sorry. Does that make sense? So there are certain things that just we cannot exchange in any sort of proper way. Okay. So solidarity, subsidiarity, double effect, rightly ordered desires, and incommensurability. Those are the things that we're going to put on the table as ways of using, of analyzing economic relationships. Quickly then, a few considerations about economics, or sort of just some, what's at stake in a lot of this. So for corporations, profit maximization. This is what drives everything. Make the most money for your shareholders, stakeholders, right? Profit maximization. So the reason for the existence of a corporation is to make money for the people who invest in it. That's one major, the dominant form of economic theory in sort of regular business relationships. So much so, it's so dominant that when major business figures about 2 or 3 weeks ago released a statement saying this might be a problem, it made front page news around the world, right? Just to question that. Whether the reason for the existence of work itself is to make as much money for the people who invest in it as possible, even to question that, raise red flags around the world. Second, one of the things that is valued at a very high level in contemporary economic theory is efficiency. Don't do anything at a slower level or a slower pace, or with any sort of redundancy that you can eliminate, right? Thirdly, contemporary economic relationships, and I think probably just as a whole, all economic relationships depend upon some sorts of structural inequalities. And this is something you just have to take into account. You have to realize that there are injustices or at least inequalities in the way that we pursue everything from buying a cup of coffee to driving down the road. And finally, the fourth consideration when we're talking about economics is the way that the contemporary world of finance and economics and money and et cetera is meant to shape our desires. This is why I said this would be a very important thing. So if you watch Mad Men, for instance, right? The thing that you're trying to do is not just to get people to buy things. You're trying to get people to want things. They don't even know they want them. How would you know you wanted a new iPhone if you did not know that it existed? You already have one. Right? So the whole game is built on inculcating desires, or better put, shaping desires that are natural to humans. We are desiring creatures. We are bundles of love. We just love things. We want them. We're drawn to them. And if we can figure out how to induce and shape and form those desires in such a way that it makes us money, well, there you go. It helps drive profit maximization. And if you can form people's desires, it's quicker than trying to get your wares peddled around somewhere, right? You get them to come to you. So it actually increases efficiency. Like, desire shaping is the game. All right. Finally, a word about the poor in Christian thought. And here I'm just going to mention that a few years ago in this room, Gary Anderson, also from University of Notre Dame, I'm not shilling for Notre Dame, this is not me shaping your desires to go to their school. Gary Anderson is a professor at Notre Dame, gave a talk on the place of the poor in Christian, or like early Christian history, to the point where his argument is, look, the The early church so valued the poor, they thought of them in the same way that they thought of the Eucharist. The poor were sacraments. The poor actually, if you gave charity, it was believed the poor would actually petition God for you in the afterlife. So the same sort of logic that drives the Eucharist, that Christ is present to us, mediating our existence here in relationship to God, is true about the poor. Anytime that you're in the presence of the poor, you are given the opportunity to commune with God. I'm just mentioning that because it's a complete reversal of the way that we talk about something like profit maximization, right? And it's really helpful. And you can probably, if you talk to, I don't know, Mother Rebecca or somebody, find that lecture, that recording. I'm guessing it's somewhere around here. And if not, you can buy his book called Charity and read it. And the last thing I want to say before we talk about cases is the logic of that exchange between profit maximization and valuing the poor, which has to do, again, with value and desire, affection, whatever. And it's this. There's a really common idea that people deserve whatever state they're in financially. And this doesn't just work one way, as in the poor or the deserving poor, and you can separate the deserving poor from the undeserving poor. It's also in the rich. The rich deserve whatever they have. Right? They work for it, it's theirs. And there's a really basic moral sort of intuitive moral reason here, right? Like, if you do something and you affect the outcome of it, that outcome should somehow correspond to your existence. In other words, you don't want things to be stolen from you, right? Stealing is wrong, and so whatever you have is yours, and so you deserve to have it. I want to just point out that the idea of just desserts in this strictly like economic transactional way is deeply, deeply incongruous with the doctrine of grace, which is to say that there is nothing you can do. Well, to put it the way that I once heard somebody say, there's nothing you can do to make God love you less. But for very, very many of us, it's much more difficult to believe there's nothing you can do to make God love you more. So to say that we deserve to be in the financial state that we are in, given some sort of like work ethic idea, is itself something that I think is worth asking questions about. Which is not to say that I have the answers about them. I can point you to people who are doing work on this. But keeping in mind what it means to think that people deserve to be in the financial state they are in is a difficult but worthwhile endeavor when you're thinking in terms of Christian faith. Okay, questions? All right. One of the things that's become apparent to me in the first few weeks is that it's difficult for me to generate the kinds of cases that I just want to bring to the table for this group. Because it's different, it's very different than casework that you might assign for like a course, like a graduate course, right? Because I could presuppose if this were a course that I had at least assigned you reading, even if I did not presuppose that you'd done it. And then I could work with sort of the logic of that body of literature to say, let's examine this thing given these parameters. So what I've just done is like dumped several moral principles here for us to sort of evaluate. And what I'd like to do, if it's okay with you, is to suggest that what we do is take a really broad topic rather than a narrow case and evaluate it in these three different ways: through the lens of personal finance, public policy or corporate realities, and the church's sort of response to it. And the one that springs to mind most readily for me is, not least because of the current political climate, student loans. And I actually was looking this up just this morning to see if I could find a quick summary of the arguments, and I did not. But what I did find, if you're interested, I can ask Mother Rebecca to send this out. Let's see. Is from Business Insider. 11 mind-blowing facts that show just how dire the student loan crisis in America is. Let me give you a handful of these so that you can get have a little bit of ammunition about what's in what to talk about. The national total student debt is now over $1.5 trillion. So that's one thing. College tuition has more than doubled since the 1980s. I'm a college administrator, so I don't want to say that like it's, you know, all our fault. More than 3 million senior citizens are still paying off their student loans. As of May 2018, 101 people in the U.S. owe at least $1 million each in student loans. Black families carry more debt than white families and are more likely to default on their loans. As many as 40% of borrowers could default on their student loans by 2023. That's worth considering at the structural level, right? 40% of $1.5 trillion. Of people who use bankruptcy assistance service to file for Chapter 7 bankruptcy protection, 32% carry student loan debt. Some U.S. workers would even ditch vacation time for help paying their loans. So if you're talking about time away from your families or children, right, to do this, you're talking about giving up the only, like you're talking about serfdom. That's the sort of technical term for what's being described there. Student loan debt is the reason 13% of Americans in a survey conducted last year said they decided not to have kids. So the decline of like family relationships goes all the way to the level of just having families. Some have drawn parallels between the student debt crisis and the subprime mortgage disaster. That's not surprising when you run those numbers, 40% of $1.5 trillion. Nearly 50% of millennials who have or had student loan debt think college wasn't worthwhile. I'd like to talk with them, again, as a college administrator. So that's 11 facts about the current state of student loans. So what I'd like to propose is that we break into three groups and we discuss this. So just in a 1-2-3 fashion, you would get personal finance. This group back here, y'all can divide however you want to. This group back here would get like public policy, like what sorts of things should be on the table. And then this group would get what the church might have to say or do about this. Okay? So let me rerun for you like questions that we would want to ask, which is to say, what sort of authority do we have? So this group back here probably can't fix like $1.5 trillion worth of stuff. In reality, none of these three groups can fix it. So you want to ask like who has the authority? What's really going on is the kind of analysis. Which goals would we want to pursue here? Is it the eradication of student loan debt, or is it the eradication of the structures that make student loan possible, etc.? And who would be some exemplars of negotiating this sort of problem? All right. So you have, I think, 15 minutes to solve the student loan crisis. So go for it.